From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
Most people seem to think we got into Iraq because of intelligence failures. I really think exactly the opposite is what happened, that we got into Iraq because of an intelligence success. And by that, I mean successful disinformation operation, a successful black propaganda operation.
Investigative journalist Craig Unger on the fall of the House of Bush, the untold story of how a band of true believers seized the executive branch, started the Iraq War, and still imperils America's future. But first, will the Senate hold telecom companies accountable for spying on the American people? And two marches this weekend, beginning today in Washington, D.C., against a wave of hate crimes and police brutality. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting from Washington, D.C. In Pakistan, opposition leader and former Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto has been freed from a three-day house arrest. She'd been confined to her Lahore home in General Pervez Musharraf's crackdown on protests to his emergency rule. Bhutto has ruled out any power-sharing deal with Musharraf and is calling for a people's revolution to oust his government. Her release came hours before Musharraf swore in a new cabinet after his term officially expired. Musharraf will remain in office pending the outcome of a Supreme Court challenge to his election win last month. He's expected to win the case, having dismissed judges who've shown independence. In Iraq, the U.S. occupation force has hit a record high. The Washington Post reports the U.S. troop contingent is now at 175,000, the largest since the U.S. invasion 4.5 years ago. The number is expected to decline over several months. Iraq's oil minister is predicting Iraq is months away from approving a long-awaited oil law. The measure has stalled in parliament over disagreements on regional distribution and the involvement of foreign firms. Speaking at the OPEC summit in Saudi Arabia, Hussein al-Sharastani said the law would cancel any current oil deal signed by the regional Kurdish government in northern Iraq.
Those contracts have no standing with the government of Iraq. We have informed and warned the companies that there will be different consequences of signing such contracts, and Iraq will not allow its oil to be exported under any such
consequences.
Al-Sharastani also said oil cooperation with Iran is advancing, with plans to supply Iran with 100,000 barrels a day through a southern pipeline. A California federal appeals court has rejected the Bush administration's fuel economy standards for trucks and SUVs. On Thursday, a three-judge panel struck down the year-old regulations after ruling they don't go far enough to limit the vehicle's damaging contribution to global warming. The court has ordered the Transportation Department to produce new rules. The regulations were challenged by a coalition of environmental groups and 13 states and cities. A newly disclosed secret manual from the Guantanamo Bay prison shows the Pentagon has made it official policy to deny prisoners access to monitors from the International Committee of the Red Cross. Written in 2003, the manual instructs guards to deny access to the Quran and bar Red Cross visits in order to, quote, exploit the disorientation and disorganization felt by a newly arrived detainee, unquote. The document also authorizes guards to prevent Red Cross visits even to long-term detainees. Legal experts say the policy could amount to a serious breach of international humanitarian law. The document was first posted on the website WikiLeaks. The Pentagon does not dispute its authenticity, but says prisoners are now allowed Red Cross visits. On Capitol Hill, both the full House and the Senate Judiciary Committee have passed bills rejecting blanket immunity for telecommunication companies that cooperate with the Bush administration's warrantless spy program. The measures amend the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act and pave the way for courts to decide whether telecom companies might have broken the law. The Bush administration has threatened a veto. We'll have more on this story after headlines. The Canadian government has ordered a review of stun gun use following the release of video footage showing a fatal police tasering of an unarmed man last month. 40-year-old Robert Jasansky had flown in from Poland to live with his mother. He became agitated after spending hours waiting for her in a secure area at Vancouver International Airport. She told him to wait for him by the baggage claim, when, in fact, he would have had to first pass through customs to see her. After 10 hours, Jaskansky picked up a small wooden table and began to act unruly. Police tasered him, killing him within minutes. Paul Pritchard is the traveler who caught the incident on tape.
So, well, he basically shrugged his shoulders. He put out his hands and kind of admitted defeat, if you will. And, you know, he'd been banging things. It looked like he admitted. He pointed at the computer by his side. You know, he broke something. He's, you know, okay, do what you need to do, obviously. Arrest him or whatever. He just wanted to see his mother. I mean, it's been in there for 10 hours. And, you know, they tasered him. They used their taser at that point.
In addition to the taser review, Canadian police say they're conducting a separate investigation. The world's top panel of environmental experts is set to release a new report on human-caused climate change this weekend. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change is expected to summarize its three previous reports this year that have lobbied for drastic change to avoid environmental catastrophe. Panel member Kirsty Hamilton says evidence that human activity is causing global warming is now beyond dispute.
It's their fourth assessment report, and it's 17 years after the first one, so it's an entire generation worth of scientific knowledge that's becoming ever more confident about the observations they were making way back in 1990. So clearly that's just a solid reinforcement for governments and everybody on the planet about the urgency of the matter.
The release of the report comes amid censorship allegations. This week, the World Wildlife Fund accused leading polluter nations of diluting the climate report to discourage taking action. Meanwhile, accusations of climate change censorship are now reaching the halls of the Smithsonian National Museum of Natural History in Washington. The Washington Post reports museum directors took steps to downplay global warming at an Arctic exhibit to avoid a political fallout. Museum director Christian Samper imposed last-minute changes to the exhibit's script that raised scientific uncertainty about climate change. The move came after Samper held up the project for 6 months, ordered reviews from other government agencies, and moved a climate change discussion in the exhibit to less prominence. In other environmental news, new satellite imaging of the Gulf Coast shows hurricanes Katrina and Rita produced the nation's worst forestry disaster on record. Researchers from Tulane University say the hurricanes killed or damaged some 320 million trees in Mississippi and Louisiana. Scientists predict the destruction will have major environmental effects. The decaying trees will put as much carbon into the air as the rest of the nation's forests will remove through 1 year of photosynthesis. The loss of so many trees at once has exposed large tracts to aggressive and populous species that will replace native environmentally beneficial ones. The Washington Post reports attempts to contain the damage have been hampered by an ineffective federal program that's spent only $70 million so far. James Cummins of the conservation group Wildlife Mississippi said, quote, "This is the worst environmental disaster in the United States since the Exxon Valdez accident and the greatest forest destruction in modern times." The Mexican government is raising major environmental concerns over the Bush administration's plans for a massive wall along the southern border. In a new report, Mexico says the proposed border wall would cause severe environmental damage, threatening the survival of hundreds of plant species and animals. The report calls the U.S. plans, quote, medieval. Homeland Security Secretary Michael Chertoff says he's been granted congressional authority to waive environmental laws to continue the wall's construction. An American power company, named in a new report on the world's worst polluters, is also a major donor to President Bush. According to the Center for Global Development, Southern Company is in the top two of the worst utility polluters in the U.S. and ranks sixth worst in the world. One Southern plant in Juliet, Georgia, emits more carbon dioxide every year than Brazil's entire power sector. Finance records show Southern Company employees have donated more than $6 million to Republican campaigns since 1990, including more than $200,000 to elect President Bush. The Los Angeles Police Department has announced it's canceling an extensive mapping program to identify Muslim enclaves across the city. The plan had sparked outrage from some Islamic groups and civil libertarians. A soldier who served two combat tours in Iraq has been arrested for leaving the Army without permission to seek help for post-traumatic stress disorder. Sergeant Brad Gaskin says he left his base in August 2006 because he wasn't receiving effective treatment from the military. Gaskins had been diagnosed with PTSD and severe depression. Gaskin said, quote, "They just don't have the resources to handle it, but that's not my fault," he said. A CBS News study this week found more than 6,000 U.S. veterans took their own lives in 2005, an average of 17 a day. Meanwhile, two service members who fled to Canada to avoid serving in Iraq have been denied a bid for refugee status there. On Thursday, Canada's Supreme Court denied to hear an appeal from Jeremy Hinsman and Brandon Huey. Both face up to 5 years in prison if deported back to the United States. New figures reveal the United States has become a haven for accused war criminals from around the world. According to the Department of Homeland Security, more than 1,000 people accused of crimes, including rape, killings, torture, and genocide abroad, are living in the U.S. Democratic Senator Richard Durbin of Illinois says torture is currently the only serious human rights violation committed abroad that can lead to prosecution of a non-American national on U.S. soil. Durbin's leading a congressional effort to add more offenses under the law. A group of domestic workers employed by foreign diplomats living in the U.S. has filed a petition with an international commission claiming exploitation and abuse. The workers say they were forced into slave-like conditions in the homes of diplomats from countries including Bolivia, Bangladesh, and Kuwait. Their allegations include extreme wage and hour violations, virtual imprisonment in the homes of their employers, and physical and emotional abuse. The American Civil Liberties Union says it brought the case to the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights because the diplomats are granted immunity under U.S. law. The petition accuses the U.S. of violating international treaties by failing to ensure immunized diplomats are barred from abusing human rights. Here in New York, a group of hunger-striking students at Columbia University have won a victory in their effort to expand ethnic studies at their school. On Thursday, Columbia administrators agreed to spend $50 million on expanding the Office of Multicultural Affairs and changing how the culture's requirement is taught. The students have been camped out in the center of campus during their week-long protest. And in Australia, a coroner has ruled that five Australian journalists were deliberately killed by Indonesian troops in East Timor 32 years ago. Australian television correspondent Greg Shackleton and his crew had come to East Timor to report on the events leading up to the Indonesian invasion. It's long been known they were killed on the orders of Indonesian generals to stop them from exposing the Indonesian military's mass killings of Timorese. But no charges have been filed against the soldiers or generals involved. Australian prosecutors say three Indonesian military officials could face war crimes charges. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Despite threats of a White House veto, both the full House and the Senate Judiciary Committee passed bills Thursday rejecting blanket immunity for telecommunication companies that cooperate with the Bush administration's program of warrantless wiretapping. The White House said the House bill, quote, dangerously weakens national security and, quote, fails to protect companies facing massive lawsuits. Both bills amend the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, or FISA, and pave the way for courts to decide whether telecom companies might have broken the law when they participated in the warrantless wiretapping program. The Senate Judiciary Committee vote on the bill follows the Senate Intelligence Committee vote in October. But the Senate Intelligence Committee had approved a version that included telecom amnesty. The Senate leadership is expected to decide which of the two proposals will be considered by the full Senate. Michelle Richardson is legislative consultant for the American Civil Liberties Union, where she lobbies on national security issues. Before joining the ACLU, she was counsel to John Conyers on the House Judiciary Committee, where she specialized in national security issues, constitutional law, and government oversight. Michelle Richardson joins me here in Washington, D.C. Michelle, welcome to Democracy Now! Talk about the significance of yesterday's vote, and then we'll go on to talk about what the Senate might do.
Vote was huge. We didn't know where immunity was going in the Senate and whether any of the Democrats were going to stand up to the president's proposal to give them blanket amnesty. Mr. Leahy, during the markup, went ahead and moved the bill without immunity, positioning Mr. Reid so that he could bring a bill to the floor without any immunity whatsoever right now.
Explain exactly what the House bill and the Senate Judiciary bill do.
They both provide for basically warrantless surveillance of Americans' international communications. The president has been pushing for those bills to also include retroactive immunity for all of the communication providers who warrantlessly wiretapped Americans since September 11th. Both bills refused to do that, though, and now the president is threatening to veto those bills for the lack of immunity.
Talk about the forces involved here. What is the power of Verizon, AT&T? How are they lobbying? I mean, you're lobbying on the Hill. What do you see them doing?
Well, they are a tremendous lobby here in D.C. They have their own lobbyists. They hire outside lobbyists. And really, those of us who work on civil liberties just can't compete with the money and the resources that this industry has. They have been pushing nonstop since the story broke in December of 2005 to kill these cases and be absolved of any liability whatsoever for spying on their own customers. Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about the lawsuits that have been filed and what they mean, what could happen to them under the laws being proposed?
Well, right now, the bill that came out of the Senate Intelligence Committee would kill all pending cases, not just the cases seeking monetary damages, but even the cases just seeking to find out what happened to our phone calls and our phone records, and the cases that are just seeking injunctive relief to get a ruling that warrantless wiretapping is illegal and that it shouldn't happen in the future. It would allow the Attorney General to single-handedly dismiss all 40-some-odd cases without any showing that the surveillance was actually lawful.
According to the Center for Responsive Politics, AT&T has one of the most powerful war chests in Washington. Through its Political Action Committee, it's already contributed more than $1 million to candidates in the current election cycle. Do you see a direct correlation with where these candidates stand?
I don't know if I would say they're necessarily bought off, but the money is a huge influence. And the telecom industry is so intertwined with D.C., and it always has been, that it's really a uphill battle that we really need people to be fighting with us to make sure that they aren't just let off the hook without a full accounting of what they actually did with our information and guarantees that it won't happen again in the future.
The Electronic Frontier Foundation, can you explain their lawsuit?
Yes, they are suing AT&T out in California. They have a very interesting case because they actually have direct evidence of the program, which many of the cases don't have. They have a whistleblower who worked for AT&T and actually saw the room where the NSA was literally copying everything that came into and out of those servers, including all of the internet traffic of all of their customers.
Mark Klein, you're talking
about. Yes.
So, right now, what is the Senate going to do? The House has passed their bill. The Senate Judiciary and the Senate Judiciary and Intelligence Committees have each passed bills. So, what happens now?
Well, right now, it's up to Senator Reid to decide which bill goes to the floor. We really hope it is the Judiciary bill. It's the one that has been through both committees, that has been revised, and it, you know, has a vote that says that immunity should be battled on the floor. Mr. Reid hopefully will send that judiciary bill to the floor without immunity, and then it will be on the Republicans and other friends of the telecom industry to put immunity back in the bill, as opposed to sending a bill to the floor with immunity, whereby the burden would be on us to take it out.
The telecom companies are arguing that they can't defend themselves in court because of national security, and that's why they need immunity. Your response, Michelle Richardson?
Well, you know, they can always say they didn't do anything. If they didn't wiretap Americans without warrants, they could simply say that. What they want to do is say, well, the president told us it was okay, we had no ability to defy him, and that's not a legal justification. We have to realize these aren't mom-and-pop organizations that don't know the law. These are very sophisticated, massive companies with lots of lawyers who knew what they were doing was illegal at the time they were doing it. They just really didn't expect to be caught.
Verizon, AT&T have not admitted they cooperated with the program. They're just not commenting. Quest says they didn't, and the chief executive, Joe Nacho, has charged the administration punished him by denying him lucrative government contracts.
Correct. And that's a good example that, you know, these companies could have stood up and said, no, please go to court, get the warrant, we'll cooperate, but we're not going to spy on our customers without a lawful reason to do so. We really hope that companies follow Quest's leadership in the future and demand that the government actually follow the law.
When is the vote going to take place in the Senate?
Most likely in December.
And what power do people have to weigh in?
Tremendous power. You know, a lot of groups organized this week to call in to Senators Feinstein and Whitehouse and some of the other opinion makers on the Intelligence and Judiciary Committees, and it really made a difference. We went into this markup thinking that we would be facing a horrible telecom immunity provision, but we came out of that markup with no immunity, and that really speaks to the power of the people, and we need to keep pushing. We need to let Senator Reid know that we want a bill to go to the floor that doesn't have immunity in it, and that it has to be on the Republicans and other friends of the telecom industry to get their 60 votes to put it back into the bill.
Michelle Richardson, I want to thank you for being
with
us, legislative consultant for the ACLU. When we come back from break, we're joined by investigative reporter Craig Unger. He has a new book out. It's called The Fall of the House of Bush. Stay with us.
Who would Jesus fall? Yeah, who would Jesus kill? The double talk is past so real. The word of God is now the word of hate. War is peace and freedom is the police state. Can't you see the writing on the wall? Democracy lays trampled on the floor. You better believe that, hell yeah, I'm confused for sure. What I thought was the new millennium is 1984. Mr. Orwell from the grave, adding fresh air to the page as the young president declares an end to war.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman, as we turn now to investigative journalist Craig Unger in our in Washington, D.C., here with Democracy Now! He's author of the new book, The Fall of the House of Bush, the untold story of how a band of true believers seized the executive branch, started the Iraq War, and still imperils America's future. The book examines how neoconservatives secretly forged an alliance with the Christian right during the Bush presidency and helped make the case for war in Iraq. Craig Unger is the contributing editor at Vanity Fair, also author of the book House of Bush, House of Saud. Craig, welcome to Democracy Now!
Thanks for having me, Amy.
Why don't you start off by laying out the thesis of this book?
Well, I think when most people look at the Middle East conflict today, they frame it in terms of Islam versus the West. I want to try looking at a new paradigm, and that is the battle that is, I want to examine fundamentalisms, and by that I mean not just Islamic fundamentalism, but Christian and Jewish fundamentalism as well. And I really throw in neoconservatism as sort of a secular form of fundamentalism, which are in conflict with a modern post-Enlightenment world. And I think that's a larger conflict that has gotten us into trouble today in the Middle East.
Talk about President Bush. President George W. Bush's relationship with George H.W. Bush, a central theme that runs through the fall of the House of Bush.
Right. Well, you may have seen there have been a raft of stories recently that they have a very congenial relationship. Last summer, the New York Times had them playing horseshoes out in Kennebunkport, Maine. And on the surface, I think that's the case. I interviewed Bob Strauss, for example, who had been chairman of the National Democratic Party. He was a friend of Bush Sr.'s and had been ambassador to Moscow when the elder George Bush was president. And he said that when he had dinner with the two men, they would just be gossiping, talking about, oh, how's Susie doing in Midland, Texas, and so on. But under the surface, I think there's a real very deep conflict that has affected millions of lives, cost hundreds of billions of dollars, and they represent almost polar opposite points of view. I call the first conflict, first chapter in my book, Oedipus Tex. And if you look at the current Bush administration, you realize he's put together an administration consisting of some of his father's worst enemies. For example, his father was a very congenial man, had very few bitter enemies, but one of them was certainly Donald Rumsfeld. In addition, his father had very little—was not terribly fond of the Christian right, and at one point he called them the extra chromosome crowd, a remark for which he had to apologize. And finally, his father had been doing battle with the neoconservatives as early as 1976. If you go back to that period, Bush Sr. was then head of the CIA, and you see the young neocons then had put together what was known as Team B, and they began to challenge the CIA's intelligence on the Cold War. This was the era of détente. They were saying the CIA was a bunch of liberals who were being soft on the Soviet Union. And they tried to come up with—they began to politicize intelligence and distort it and come up with a much tougher line. And in there, I think you see a lot of the foreshadowing of the events we're going through today.
As we talk about how President Bush and Vice President Cheney made the case for war in Iraq, I want to turn to comments made by Dick Cheney in September of 1992. At the time, he was President George H.W. Bush's Secretary of Defense. During an address at the Economic Club of Detroit, Cheney was asked why the United States didn't bury Saddam Hussein during the Gulf War. This is how he responded close to 15 years ago.
At the end of the war in the Gulf, when we made the decision to stop, we did so because we had achieved our military objectives. That is, when we decided to halt military operations. And those objectives were twofold: to liberate Kuwait, and secondly, to strip Saddam Hussein of his offensive military capability, of his capacity to threaten his neighbors. And we'd done that. There's no doubt in my mind but what we could have gone on to Baghdad and taken Baghdad, occupied the whole country. We had the 101st Airborne up on the Euphrates River Valley, about halfway between Kuwait and Baghdad. And I don't think, from a military perspective, that it would have been an impossible task. Clearly, it wouldn't, given the forces that we had there. But we made a very conscious decision not to proceed for several reasons, in part because as soon as you go to Baghdad to get Saddam Hussein, you have to recognize that you're undertaking a fairly complex operation. It's not the kind of situation where we could have pulled up in front of the presidential palace in Baghdad and said, come on, Saddam, you're going to the slammer. We would have had to run him to ground. A lot of places he could have gone to hide out or to resist. It would have required the extensive military forces to achieve that. But let's assume for the moment that we would have been able to do it. We've got Saddam now, and maybe we put him down there in Miami with Noriega. Then the question comes, putting a government in place of the one you've just gotten rid of. You can't just sort of turn around and walk away. You've now accepted the responsibility for what happens in Iraq. What kind of government do you want us to create in place of the old Saddam Hussein government? You want a Sunni government or a Shia government? Or maybe it ought to be a Kurdish government? Or maybe one based on the Ba'ath Party? Or maybe some combination of all of those? How long is that government likely to survive without U.S. military forces there to keep it propped up? If you get into the business of committing U.S. forces on the ground in Iraq to occupy the place, my guess is I'd probably still have people there today instead of having been able to bring them home. We would have been in a situation once we went into Baghdad where we would have engaged in the kind of street-by-street, house-to-house fighting in an urban setting that would have been dramatically different from what we were able to do in the Gulf. in Kuwait, in the desert, where our precision-guided munitions and our long-range artillery and tanks were so devastating against those Iraqi forces. You would have been fighting in a built-up urban area, large civilian population, and much heavier prospects for casualties. You would have found as well, I think, probably the disintegration of the Arab coalition that signed on to support us in our efforts to eject the Iraqis from Kuwait, but never signed on for the proposition that the United States would become some kind of quasi-permanent occupier of a major Middle Eastern nation. And the final point with respect to casualties, everybody, of course, was tremendously impressed with the fact that we were able to prevail at such a low cost, given the predictions with respect to casualties in major modern warfare. But for the 146 Americans who were killed in action, and for their families, it was not a cheap or a low-cost conflict. The bottom line question for me was, how many additional American lives is Saddam Hussein worth? And the answer, not very damn many. I think the president got it right both times, both when he decided to use military force to defeat Saddam Hussein's aggression, but also when he made what I think was a very wise decision to stop military operations when we did.
That was Dick Cheney speaking in September of 1992 at the Economic Club of Detroit. Our guest is investigative journalist Craig Unger. Pretty astounding, Craig.
It's an extraordinary tape, and Cheney made statements like that again and again between 92 and 1994. And he really forecast all the problems we're encountering today. It's a shame he didn't look at them again. But if anything, to me, it shows his duplicity. At about the same time, remember, he was Secretary of Defense back then, and under him, he had some of the key neoconservatives who became architects of the Iraq war today. He had Paul Wolfowitz, Douglas Feith, Zalmay Khalilzad. And about the same time, they had just written what was known as the Defense Policy Guidance Paper, sometimes known as the Wolfowitz Doctrine. And this was a paper that became, that outlined our current strategy. It was a radical new vision for overhauling the Middle East. You see the seeds of the Iraq war in it. When it was leaked to the New York Times, it was, it caused a great outrage. And then-President Bush, the elder President Bush, rejected it out of hand. He thought it was far too radical and right-wing. But Cheney secretly liked it a lot, and he told Khalilzad, for example, you've come across a new rationale for American security. This was a vision to create American dominance throughout the new century, as just after the end of the Cold War.
Talk about Bob Strauss, his position and his observations about the two, knowing them very well, George, senior and junior. Well, not exactly junior, since he doesn't have the H, but 43 and 41, as you put it.
Right. Well, he said one thing that was—he had only a few comments, but they were both very acute. One is, he said, Bush senior doesn't know how to strut. George W. Jr. doesn't know how not to strut. I also asked him if there was one word that described the current president, and he said he was incurious. He was just too incurious to be president. And so you see this battle, the conflict between the two George Bushes evolve over a series of years. George W. Bush was not the favorite son in the family. His older brother, Jeb Bush, really was. And in 1994, the two men were running for governor of Florida and Texas, respectively. And Jeb was favored to win. George W. was favored to lose in Texas. In fact, exactly the opposite happened. And at that point, George W. Bush became the leading, sort of began to win the Oedipal sweepstakes in the family. And he became a front-runner to become a presidential candidate.
George W. Bush's comments about cut and run, a direct cut at his father?
I think it was. And what you see then, this was during the buildup to the Iraq war. He said he was reflecting back to 1991, when his father was president, during the first Gulf War, and had been criticized by the neocons. Now, the normal etiquette between former and sitting presidents is they don't criticize each other. And here he had made a public comment that seemed to be a slap at his father. I interviewed people who had been talking to the elder President Bush at that time, and Bush said, you know what, I'm going to have Brent Scowcroft talk to him. And what you see in my book is Brent Scowcroft as an intermediary between the two generations, between the two George Bushes. If there's a hero in the book, it is Scowcroft. He's in a very delicate position. He's a very close friend of the elder President Bush. He has a condo in Kennebunkport, Maine, for example, and he wants to sustain that friendship. So when he talks out publicly, he is talking with the assent of the elder President Bush. And as early as October of 1991, you see him begin. He sees it coming. He sees the neoconservatives taking over, and he starts to speak out. And you see him writing in the Wall Street Journal and other places, in the Washington Post and so on, saying that we should not go on and attack Iraq.
I want to talk about one of the main stories in your book, and that is this point you made at the top of the show, that it wasn't a failure of intelligence, the Iraq war. In fact, it was the success. Talk about it.
Right. Well, a lot of—I think everyone knows about the Valerie Plame Wilson affair and Joe Wilson. What people—and it's sometimes referred to as Nigergate. People sometimes forget the source was what is known as the Niger documents. Now, these were documents that grew out of a robbery that took place in the Niger embassy over the last weekend in the year of 2000, and January 1st, 2001. Now, remember, the timing is very important. George W. Bush has not taken office yet. But the neocons know they have a friend in the office coming into the White House. So they have had this strategy in development for many years, going back to as early as 1992, you see it begin to take shape. Now, finally, they have an opportunity to begin to try to implement it. Bush, and as early as 1998, they had begun going down to Austin. You see Paul Wolfowitz, Richard Pearl, Elliot Abrams going down to Austin, where George W. Bush is governor. The Bush Sr. has been trying to educate his son in terms of foreign policy. He thinks the old line realists will prevail. By that, I mean Colin Powell, Brent Scowcroft, and one had thought Condoleezza Rice, James Baker, for example. But in fact, a radical group of neocons have been going down there, and they've sort of been indoctrinating George W. Bush. The first review of my book, Radar Magazine, calls it the greatest brainwashing since the Manchurian Candidate. When the Niger embassy break-in takes place, it's in the Niger embassy in Rome. I actually went there for Vanity Fair. It's a terribly unprepossessing building. If the Watergate burglary is sometimes described as a third-rate burglary, well, this is a fourth-rate one, and almost nothing of value is taken, just a few documents and some stationery. But these documents were used as the basis for forgeries of documents that said that Saddam Hussein was going to buy 500 tons of yellow cake uranium from the Republic of Niger. It's a very poor African country. Its only real export is uranium. These documents then became circulated, though there are many, many unanswered questions about them. Everyone agrees on one thing, and that is that they were forgeries. They were phony. And I discovered, as I began to trace them, I discovered that they had been discredited on at least 14 separate occasions by various government agencies, by the CIA, by the intelligence arm of the State Department, and so forth. Yet they still managed to be inserted in President Bush's 2003 State of the Union address, and therefore, in that speech, they became a casus belli, a cause for war.
And the role of Dick Cheney in the manufacturing, well, you call it a psyops operation, psychological operations.
Right. Well, in terms of the Niger documents, I'm not sure I do have a direct link with Dick Cheney, but what you see, Stephen Hadley says that he forgot that they had been discredited. Now, it's hard to believe if you think about it, about vetting a presidential address, not just a presidential address, but a State of the Union address, one that is calling for war, that this is, you know, it sort of defies imagination that the government can forget this on 14 different occasions. But with regard to Cheney, you see him playing a remarkable role overall in putting together a team of neocons and assembling extraordinary amounts of executive power. What we really see going on here is the putting together of sort of an alternative national security apparatus. We have a $40 billion intelligence apparatus when you put together the CIA and the various intelligence units in the State Department and the Pentagon and so on. What Cheney was a brilliant master of the bureaucracy. You can trace him and Rumsfeld back to the Gerald Ford administration. There they executed a brilliant bureaucratic coup that seemed to oust Vice President Nelson Rockefeller, head of the CIA, William Colby, Defense Secretary James Schlesinger. And so they had a real mastery of the bureaucracy. They knew how to bring their bureaucracy to a halt, how to grease the wheels when necessary. They were able to put in people like John Bolton in the State Department to keep an eye on Colin Powell.
We're talking to Craig Unger. His book is just out this week. It's called The Fall of the House of Bush. You write about the significance of Pat Robertson, especially significant now with his endorsement of Rudolph Giuliani. And you go through his history back to, well, talk about Pat Robertson's father.
Well, he was a United States senator himself, and he comes from a very well-off family. Pat Robertson had put together quite a fortune in broadcasting, and yet he's really an unusual character, I mean, in the sense that he was one of the first leaders of the Christian right who had enormous political clout. At the same time, I think he's a little too extreme to have won public office. He speaks in tongues. It's hard to imagine practices like that going on in the Oval Office. Yet, in the Iowa primary of 1988, you see a great turning point where Vice President Bush is then running for office. He's the sitting vice president for an extremely popular president, Ronald Reagan. And he seems to be a strong favorite to win the next presidency. But in the Iowa primary, he comes in third behind Pat Robertson. And that's the headline, that you see the power of the Christian right there. And he realizes he has to turn to his son, George W. Bush, to help bring the Christian right into his campaign.
And Robertson was very careful there. He had a very deliberate strategy, kept reporters out of his meetings, his rallies, wanting to stay under the media radar screen so that the underestimates of his popularity would lead to big headlines when he actually organized to the point where he had such a high standing in the poll.
Absolutely. This is the birth of what is sometimes called dog whistle politics. And you see the Christian right is broadcasting one message to their base, and the general electorate doesn't seem to get it. George Bush and Karl Rove became masters of this in their campaign. And, for example, you would see George W. Bush campaigning with Roger Staubach. To the general public, that meant he was campaigning with a Super Bowl football star. But to the Christian right, that meant he was campaigning with one of the faithful, that he was one of them.
Hmm. One of the points you make is the people who are under attack under this current administration, George H.W. Bush, Brent Scowcroft, Colin Powell, they all have these military records. And the people who attack them, Dick Cheney, Paul Wolfowitz, Scooter Libby, Haile Azad, did not fight.
Right. Those are the so-called chicken hawks. And, you know, it's interesting when you go around the country talking about this stuff, how right-wing talk show hosts will sometimes say this is a left-wing book. But in truth, the hero is Brent Scowcroft, who's an extremely moderate Republican who speaks out again and again, even though he's in a very delicate position because of his friendship with Bush Sr. And most of my sources are really Republicans. There are a lot. At one point, I have 9 military and intelligence officials speaking out. They're lifelong members of the military. Most of them are lifelong Republicans as well. And they've seen their party seized. Today, the Republican Party is basically a function of the Christian right or the neoconservatives. In another world, someone like Chuck Hagel would be a serious candidate in the Republican Party. Today, a moderate like Hagel is marginalized within the party. And I think you'll see in the next election, whoever is the Republican candidate is almost certain to be committed to the current policies of George W. Bush.
You talk, Craig Unger, about American evangelism in this book. You talk about George Bush's religion. And you talk about Tim LaHaye, as well as the New Right's multi-billion-dollar effort, bankrolled by billionaire philanthropists, to completely reframe the national debate. Talk about—begin with George W. Bush and his religion and his story of his conversion with Billy Graham, which you says isn't true.
Right. Well, the widespread story, and he wrote about it, or at least it was ghostwritten in his campaign autobiography for 2000, A Charge to Keep. It's a story George Bush has told again and again that in 1985, Billy Graham was in Kennebunkport, Maine, with him and his parents, and the two men went for a long walk, and it was at that moment that he began to accept Christ. Well, Billy Graham himself says he has absolutely no memory of it. But more than that, I talked to Mickey Herskowitz, who's a Houston sports writer and a close friend of Bush Sr., and he was hired to ghostwrite that campaign autobiography, A Charge to Keep. And as he was ghostwriting it, during that process, he had about 20 sit-down interviews with George W. Bush in Austin. And he very specifically asked Bush what conversation took place with Billy Graham. At the time, Bush had absolutely no memory of the conversation himself, so Herskowitz sort of prodded him. He said, well, would he have said something like, are you right with Jesus? And Bush said, no, he wouldn't have said that. Well, at a certain point, Herskowitz gave the tapes to Karen Hughes, who was Bush's communications director. And in the course of finishing the book, Herskowitz's words were put in Billy Graham's mouth. Now, I later went back and I found a guy named Arthur Blessett. And it turns out that even earlier, it was Blessett who really converted Bush to Jesus. In 1984, he had made a trip to Midland, Texas, and then met at a Holiday Inn. There were 3 people present at the meeting. Bush, a member of his Bible studies group named Jim Sale, I talked to Jim Sale, and Arthur Blessed himself, who I also interviewed. And Blessed is most famous for carrying a 12-foot cross of Jesus around the world. He's been to more than 300 countries, walked 30,000 miles, and he had a Jesus coffee house in Los Angeles where he was most famous for what was called the toilet baptism. His congregation consisted mostly of Hell's Angels people, bikers and so forth, and they would dump their drugs in the toilet, flush it down the toilet, and embrace Jesus.
And that's who you say influenced George W. Bush, converted him.
Right. He actually seems like a very nice man. He's not quite as distinguished a figure as Billy Graham, however, and I think it plays better politically. But, in addition, I think the secular world has basically misunderstood the Christian right and doesn't quite understand the depths of this as a movement. And I traveled undercover with Tim LaHaye, who is the prophet of the Left Behind series. His books have sold an astonishing 63 million copies. I traveled with him to the battlefield of Armageddon, where they believe the final conflict would take place. And I also did research, and I began to trace it back to its roots, the roots of the Christian right. And we often talk about the battle of the blue states or the red states or the culture wars in America. I think it's actually a much more profound division of faith versus science.
Craig Unger, with the story, this undercover tour you took, Walking Where Jesus Walked, with LaHaye, and the scene that you describe, touring the ancient fortress city of Megiddo?
Yes. Megiddo is—from Megiddo, we get the term Armageddon, where the final conflict will take place. Har means hill in Hebrew, and Har Megiddo is how we get the word Armageddon. And in the Book of Revelations, this is where the final conflict will take place. And I was walking up the hill with LaHaye and about 90 of his followers, and as you look over this spectacularly beautiful pastoral valley, you see a valley that, in their view, won't be so bucolic—they see a vision that is not so bucolic. They see that it will be filled with blood, the blood of as many as 2 billion people. And I talked with them about that, and they say it'll be a river of blood, 200 miles long, about 4.5 feet deep. And I asked one of them when all this would take place, and they said very soon, but not soon enough, any day now. So they see this fantasy is taking place, and this is sort of one of the horrific visions that is spelled out in the Book of Revelation.
Filled with the blood of the more than 2 billion people who did not accept Jesus Christ as
absolutely
their Savior. And Tim LaHaye's relationship with George W. Bush?
LaHaye is one of the founders of the Council for National Policy. Now, this is a not very well-known group, but it's an umbrella group that oversees dozens of Christian right groups like Focus on the Family, which is James Dobson's group. The Moral Majority was part of it, and so on. And within it was a much smaller group called the Arlington Group of about 50 religious leaders. Now, they were in regular contact with Karl Rove. And what you have in the Christian right is as many as 80 million adult evangelicals. You have about 200,000 pastors, and they operate almost as precinct captains did in the labor unions for the Democratic Party. So this is a vast populist movement that operates as part of the Christian Republican Party, and they have regular contact with the White House.
Craig Unger, I want to thank you very much for joining us. The book has just come out this week. It's called The Fall of the House of Bush, the untold story of how a band of true believers seized the executive branch, started the Iraq War, and still imperils America's future. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We'll be back in a minute.
Much more than a march. It will be the beginning of a movement. Millions more movement. Let us begin.
Tell us what you hear.
Dear people of the globe, I hope that you're in good health by the time my voice hits you. I hope it all is well with you. My mission is to build with you. Touch upon some real issues. Senators, government officials, sit at the conference and listen. Have a Coke or mineral water and say I'm reminiscent of George L. Jackson, Malcolm X's last win when I'm rapping. Americans, Africans, Asians, Russians, and Arab men. Send your clergyman to journey with Nas from Queens. Projects, I promise, an unforgettable experience. Compare me with Inhotep, get in Modep. History was stolen, get in my zone. What makes the powers that be less gangster than Al Capone? The Rosetta Stone was stolen like Chicago was. Think I'm a thug? Let's talk about some conquerors. Napoleon, Sun Tzu, Genghis Khan, Hitler, Idi Amin, or Matilda the Hun. Let's bring it back to the cat that invented the gun. From the Indians all the way to the Pentagon. I'm sitting on Capitol Hill. I'm composing this rhyme, guaranteed to make all of y'all feel the beauty that was trapped under siege. Believe in yourself, you'll be free. Take it from me.
We will not surrender, and we will not back down.
We march as millions, Nass, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report, as we turn now to the activists who are arriving here in Washington, D.C. from across the country for a weekend of protests against a wave of hate crimes and increased police brutality, they say. This week alone, three African-American men were shot and killed by police officers in Brooklyn, New York, in Chicago and in Newark. Reverend Al Sharpton's National Action Network's leading a march on hate crimes at the Department of Justice today. The Hip Hop Caucus is organizing a rally and concert at the Washington Monument on Saturday. It's called Enough is Enough, Stop Hate Crimes and Police Brutality. Rosa Clemente is the executive director of the Hip Hop Caucus, longtime activist and journalist, joining us here in Washington, D.C. Welcome, Rosa. Tell us about these rallies.
Thanks, Amy. Thanks for having us. Look at what's happening. And for us to say enough is enough is just the beginning. Our rally and concert have been marched for a very, have been organized for a very long time. Post the Janice 6 mobilization, the rape and torture of Megan Williams, the rape and torture of a young mother in Dunbar Village, to Sean Bell last year, to the recent Kyle Kopp, but particularly here in D.C., the case of a young man by the name of Deontay Rawlings, that about 4.5 weeks ago was murdered by the police, the Washington Metropolitan Police. So we're coming here very supportive of what's going on the 16th today here by the National Action Network. But as the Hip Hop Caucus and a generation, we're not seeking much, and we don't believe we're going to get much from the Department of Justice, or really a lot of this governmental intervention is not what we're looking for. What we're really looking for is to bring young people outside, to get them into a place is about with massive amounts of education on the 17th.
Can you talk about these cases of the police killings in New York, as well as Chicago?
Yeah, I mean, as a longtime activist in New York, what's interesting is almost 8 years ago, I was on your show for the first time in Albany, New York, when the venue change happened in the Amadou Diallo trial in late 1999, when the trial was moved from the Bronx to Albany. So in terms of the work around police brutality, I've been part of many organizations, Malcolm X Grassroots Movement and the Justice, the People's Justice Committee out of New York. I don't think we're seeing an increase. I think what we're seeing is kind of the standard. It just happens to be in the last year. Yes, okay, we've seen an increase, but what we've been seeing really in the last year is at this point a complete disregard for young people's lives. And the police are not even trying at this point to cover up their stories, which is they're just coming out and saying, Kyle Coppin had a gun, we had to shoot him, even though this young man had bipolar and his mother had been trying to get him mental health. We have the case of Sean Bell, 50 shots. Almost a year later, now the defense team is asking for a delay in the trial, ironically, to start on February 4th, 2008, 9 years after Amadou Diallo was murdered in the Bronx. But they're also asking for a venue change. So we see this kind of, it's the standard, it's repetitive. But now what we're seeing is a nationwide pandemic. We have in 24 hours, Kyle Coppin in Brooklyn, murdered by the NYPD. An aspiring rapper in a group called Psychodrama out of Chicago, Illinois, murdered at a stop. The young man in Newark, whose name we don't know. And there has been 6 police shootings in D.C. in the last year. And now we've seen the rape and torture of young women of color. So this is part and parcel of just a wave of violence and terror against young people of color, particularly in this hip-hop generation.
Rosa Clemente, I want to thank you for being with us, executive director of the Hip Hop Caucus. She's a longtime activist and journalist. The protest will be taking place, the rally that she is a part of tomorrow, Reverend Sharpton's today at the Department of Justice, as
thank
we
you,
wrap
Amy.
Up today's broadcast. Democracy Now! Is produced by Shrifadil Kaddous, Mike Burke, Nicole Salazar, Anjali Kamat, Steve Martinez, Aaron Mate, Jeffrey Hagerman, as well as Ricardo Lobo. Special Special thanks to Samantha Chambly joining me here in Washington, D.C., and Becca Staley, and all the folks that made this broadcast possible. I'll be in Baltimore tomorrow morning giving a talk at a regional gathering of Amnesty International. All are invited, 9 a.m. at the Best Western in Baltimore, Maryland. You can go to our website at democracynow.org for a video and audio podcast for the information about the talk tomorrow. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.